Well, hey, good evening, Crosspoint. Man, we are so excited that you guys are here this evening. There we go. Man, it's really exciting to see you here tonight. We are kicking off the reboot journey, and we've been planning and talking about this for a number of weeks. Many of you are really excited, and if you're here for the first time, and we are excited you're here, there's no better time to join us here at Crosspoint than at the beginning of a series. And we are going to be rebooting our assumptions of Jesus. We're kind of, just as we saw in that video, kind of covering up some of the things, maybe even the misperceptions that we have about the figure of Jesus, and trying to get some clear pictures of who the character of Jesus really is. So it's great to have you here. If we haven't met, my name's Kurt, and if you're here every week, welcome back. It's great to see you tonight. It was really interesting, those photos that we just looked at a few moments ago that Mark had you take a survey on. I've got the results right in front of me, and I'm actually a bit surprised by them. So the first one, you know, they kind of, I don't know what you call that, mosaic Jesus or something, that only got like 12% of you really, you know, connected with that one. And then the one on the right, letter D, would you call it Keanu Reeves Jesus? about 11% of you, actually 10.4% of you on that one. The letter B, the crucifixion, ironically, that one came in second in terms of the most popular among this crowd, 28% of us, which is interesting because we have a pretty high population of Catholics in our area, and usually Catholics connect with the crucifixion of Jesus. The one most of you connected with, 49%, was letter C, Jesus holding lambs a lot. And ironically, I'm going to talk a little bit about this later, but I struggle with that one a little bit. I struggle with this idea of Jesus actually, you know, taking care of me. And so we'll dig into this a bit later, but man, we're glad you're here. I know I need to reboot some of my assumptions about Jesus. I would guess you probably do too. Let me pray for us before we dive in and go any further. God, thank you for tonight. Thank you for every single person that's here tonight. I thank you that you actually came into this world. I actually believe that. I know not all of us believe that in this room. And for those of us that are maybe trying to figure that out, we are just so glad that you're here. And God, I just ask that you would connect with us wherever we are in our spiritual orientation. God, that you would teach us and that you would reach us. And I pray that that begins right now. Amen. Well, one of the struggles that many of us are going to have during this journey, during this series, is, you know, it's the struggle to be original, the struggle to be true. And I struggle with this. I want to be original. It's probably why I wear, you know, jeans with holes in them at times, like I have on tonight, because I want to be original. I'm guessing there's not too many pastors in America wearing, you know, holy jeans on platform this weekend, right? And so I probably fit in the category of somebody who wants to be original. I think one of the reasons we have so many theories about who Jesus is because everybody's trying to find a different theory. This is one of the reasons we oftentimes get so confused when it comes to, you know, things like our personal health. Have you ever noticed how many articles there are out there that contradict one another? You know, like in grade school, you know, they taught you the food pyramid, right? And they're like, well, this is what you should eat. And then, you know, a few years later, an article comes out and says, no, that's all wrong. Like the dairy industry had way too much influence over this. You shouldn't drink that much milk. You should have a lot less milk than originally we thought. Or, you know, like the whole message for my life has been eat less red meat, right? You should eat less than more. And yet in the New York Times just this week, there was an article that said meat's bad for you. No, it's not. And they're actually finding that red meat actually may not be as bad as we thought. We need to eat more. And so we have all these messages that are contradictory. In fact, even when it comes to how many meals a day we're supposed to eat. I mean, you know, they say, well, eat three meals a day. And then somebody else comes and says, no, eat six, but eat smaller meals, six times a day. And then somebody else will say, no, you should like eat whenever you want to eat. That's the way God intended it to be. And so we just have all these messages that contradict one another, even when it comes to things like working out, right? Some of you probably work out three times a week for 30 minutes a day. And then somebody goes, no, 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 you're supposed to do that five times a week, 30 minutes a day. And then somebody else says, no, really, it should be 45 minutes a day, just three times a week. Some of you don't work out at all. I read an article a few years ago that said, you know, if you're a man, you got the testosterone thing going. And so you really don't need to be doing aerobic exercise. You just need to do circuit training and weightlifting. And yet, just this past week in Men's Health, there's an article that said, you know, stop completely skipping out on the cardio. And so, I don't know, call me a cynic, but I think one of the reasons we have so many conflicting reports on whatever the issue is in our culture today is because if I don't say something different, then nobody's going to publish my article. Nobody's going to pay me. I'm not going to get paid for the work that I'm doing. So we always have to say something different. And I think so many times we might be more interested in saying something different than actually, you know, getting down to the truth. Well, maybe you're resisting a particular image or a character trait of Jesus. Maybe there's somebody in your office or in your workspace a couple cubes down or a couple offices down, and they have all kinds of religious paraphernalia like all over the office. I mean, it's on their desk, and you go in there and you're like, man, I am not going to be like that loser down the hall. So you resist any of that kind of stuff. Or maybe, you know, your grandparents, you know, growing up, I mean, they're wonderful people. I mean, wonderful, wonderful people. They're good people. They read their Bible every day, went to church. And yet, there were moments where you saw, like, racist things come out of their life. And you thought, man, I don't want anything to do with the Jesus that they're following because maybe he's informing them on that. And so, you know, we mix a little Zen and Buddhism along with a little Eckhart Tolle and a little Oprah and a little fundamentalism, and all of a sudden we've got our own original cocktail of spirituality because we all want originality. In this journey over the next 6 weeks, we're going to try to actually look at things that are in plain sight. One of my favorite stories with Sherlock Holmes and Watson was one night when they were out camping and they're laying there and they wake up in the middle of the night and Holmes, he kind of calls out to Watson. He says, Watson, what does it mean when I see stars laying in my bed out here in the middle of the night? And of course, you know, Watson responds, he says, well, I mean, you know, infinity is an amazing thing. I mean, you know, it's almost incomprehensible, and yet we can comprehend it because we're conscious beings, and yet so many times it seems, you know, unconsciousable. And Watson Holmes says, no, you idiot. He says, it means somebody stole our tent. I can see the stars. That's what it means. Sometimes we're trying to dig so deep, right, and be so creative that we actually miss what's right there in front of us. I'm excited to be on this journey with you. I journey right alongside with you, and I have friends that are excited too. I've talked to some of my friends, they're like, man, I just need some things reset in my life. In fact, I was talking to one friend, and he deals with some shame, and he's like, man, I just need to reboot this whole shame thing going on. He knows that's not from God, but he's trying to get out from under feeling that way. Other people I know, you know, no matter what they do sexually or relationally or financially, you know, it's like, it's okay. I mean, they're picture of Jesus as buddy Jesus, you know, like anything goes. He's my friend. You know, this Jesus never holds me accountable. And their life kind of is a mess at times because they keep creating their own pain in their life. And so, you know, maybe this image of Jesus needs to get rebooted a bit. For me, as I said, I struggle at times with this idea of God, you know, being happy with me, God actually wanting to care for me, wanting to nurture me, grow me. And so I'm gonna talk a little bit more about that later. But the bottom line, I think all of us, we probably have an image of Jesus that needs a reboot. And regardless of how informed or uninformed we are in Jesus, or how, you know, accurate or inaccurate our you know, character traits of who we understand to be may be, I want to invite all of us to go on this experiment over the next 6 weeks. So for the next 6 weeks, we're going to be diving into the book of Luke. And in Luke, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, these are the four authorized biographies. And these are known as the Gospels, or the Good News. Gospel means good news. And so these are the authorized biographical accounts of Jesus' life. These are men who basically had firsthand experiences with Jesus, or they heard through eyewitnesses these events in Jesus' life, and they wrote these things down. And so we're going to take a look at something Luke says tonight, and we're actually going to read Luke throughout the next 6 weeks. One of the experiments you're going to do is read the entire book of Luke. It's in your journal, in your guidebook that you have tonight. It's one of the things we're going to do start this week. And so you're going to be reading this over the next week or two, but I want to look at a couple sections of it tonight. So Luke chapter 1, here's what it says. He begins off this way. This is Luke talking. He says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. So Luke is basically saying, hey, there's a lot of people who have written a lot of stuff down. There's a lot of stories going around. He said, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. So Luke was not one of the original 12 disciples of Jesus, all right? He was friends with a lot of these guys. He was actually best friends with Paul, the Apostle Paul, who wrote more than half of the New Testament. But Luke is a physician. He's a very educated man. He's a very, very literate man. And so he decided to gather all these accounts that are kind of floating around and begin to gather them together and compile them. And he says, I'm doing this for this guy Theophilus, and he calls him most excellent. And some people would say, well, he calls him most excellent because he must be like a really important person. He must be like some kind of like government or religious official. But see, you could also go forward a book to the book of Acts, which Luke also wrote. And in that book, Luke is talking about a guy, this slimy kind of official that he's dealing with, and he calls him most excellent as well. And so I think Luke refers to anyone who is just seeking out who Jesus is. Anybody who's a seeker trying to discover Jesus, he calls them most excellent. And so if you're here tonight and you're just like, you know, I'm not sure what I believe about Jesus. I'm really not sure, you know, about this person and if he really was the most influential person in the world. I mean, I know about him. I've heard about him. But was he just a fabrication? I mean, was Jesus just like a good magician or did he just have some kind of unique special powers? I mean, was he really the Son of God? Why do we date time against his birth? I mean, maybe you have some of these questions. Well, you try to figure this out. I think God looks at you and he's like, most excellent. That's what comes to his mind, most excellent. You're seeking out. And so way to go in like being here and in trying to figure this out. One of the things I want us to see tonight is that Jesus demands examination. All right? We have a lot of soundbite beliefs in our culture that we've heard, but sometimes we fail to just kind of really dig in and examine Jesus. In fact, one of the reasons we fail to examine Jesus is sometimes we think, well, some of the things that are written down, they never wrote down like the early, you know, eyewitness accounts of Jesus. Everything was orally transmitted. And we know how that goes, right? We've all played telephone at some point, right? You played a telephone, we start a message on one side of the room, and it kind of, you know, makes its way across to the other side of the room, one person, the next. And what happens by the time it hits the other side of the room? It's like a totally different, you know, message, right? Not even close to what the original message was. And so the question becomes, how can we trust that what we have about Jesus is entirely accurate? Well, this deserves examination. And so one of the things I want us to understand is that in the ancient world, very little was written down. That mostly what was written down was when kings would give edicts. They would hire a scribe to record the edict. And so most ancient societies, things were handed down through an oral transmission. They transmitted things orally from one generation to the next. This is how they got their information. And so we judge them. We're like, well, why would they do it that way? Well, it's like you and I going, well, why didn't they back in like 1980, you know, post things that happened on the Instagram or Facebook? Well, it's because it didn't exist, right? I mean, that's like a pretty modern thing. It's the same way with writing things down. It didn't really quite exist. And so oral transmission of data was actually held in very, very high esteem. People would speak into this process. They corrected one another. They stewarded it very, very carefully. And so finally somebody came along and said, you know, we should just write this stuff down. And so I want you to take a look at this kind of fascinating information that comes from a guy who's really dug into this. Take a look at this guy right here.
Whenever historians are assessing whether a document is trustworthy or not, there's a certain set of tests they apply to these documents. When you apply those same tests to the Gospels, they come out with flying colors. We discuss this a lot. My friend Paul Eddy and I discuss this a lot in our book, The Jesus Legend. But if you apply the Gospels to the same critical historical standards you apply to any other ancient document, whether it's written by Lucian or Suetonius or Tacitus or Livy or whoever, the Gospels just give us every reason to believe that they are generally trustworthy. They're not fabricated. They're not legend. They're passing on historically reliable information. For example, one of the tests is the test of detail. Records that reflect eyewitness reports tend to have superfluous detail in them, whereas fabricated accounts in the ancient world tend to lack that. Well, the Gospels are just full of this extraordinary superfluous detail. Even more impressive, they're full of details that you think that they would have left out if the Gospels were being fabricated. I mean, for example, the way, you know, Jesus treats women and the fact that women are the ones to discover the tomb being empty. In first century Jewish culture, women were regarded as being untrustworthy. They weren't allowed to testify in court unless their witness was corroborated by a male. And yet the Gospels tell us that after Jesus was crucified, it was women who went to the tomb. Where are the guys? Well, the guys are scared and they're in hiding. It's the guys who are writing these documents, and it would be in their self-interest to leave that kind of information out. The fact that that kind of detail is included in the gospel really contributes to our confidence that they're passing on trustworthy information. And there's a number of other tests that we could go into as well. But by ordinary historical standards, the gospels come up with flying colors.
Interesting. Now, the real struggle on this for some of us is going to be, as we go on this journey, as I said, we're gonna read through the entire book of Luke. And there's going to be moments where you might go, well, you know, how do I know that this event in the book of Luke actually happened? I mean, we can certainly disagree with something we read. We don't have to, you know, you may not agree with it. But how do I know that Jesus actually said that? Well, one of the ways we do this is we apply some of the same standards in determining authenticity of the Gospels that we would to any other ancient antiquity. And so I want us to look at just some apple-to-apple comparisons on the screen right here and see how we would do this, like in the scholarly world. And so anybody heard of Plato? You guys heard of Plato before? Like two? Oh, yeah, you have heard of Plato. All right, well, Plato, what's interesting about Plato, he wrote the Tetralogies, right? And Plato, he wrote these somewhere between 427 and 347 BC. The earliest copy of his writings we have was written in 900 AD. There's no original copies, and I'll speak to that in just a moment. But the time span from when he originally wrote this to the time when we have the first copy in hand, get this, it's 1,200 years between when it actually happened and when it's written down. And we actually have seven copies in hand. And it's actually better that we have a number of copies versus the original. Because if all you had was the original, then you go, well, I don't even know if this is true or false because I don't have anything to compare it to. But when you have multiple originals, you can compare them against each other and actually evaluate their accuracy. Now, there's another person, Aristotle, you know, one of his contemporaries. You probably heard of Aristotle. He wrote stuff in 384 to 322 BC. The earliest document or copy of his works that we have in hand was written in 1100 AD. The time span between when it actually was written and the first copy we have is 1100 years. And we actually have 49 copies of some of these writings from Aristotle. And when we read them, we're pretty confident. We go, you know, when we read this, we're pretty confident this is what Aristotle thought. You may have even studied some of his thoughts. Somebody else, Homer, wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Iliad was written in 900 BC. The earliest copy is 400 BC. And so the time span there is only 500 years, so a lot closer between the original writing and the first copy. And when you look at the Iliad, nobody steps back and goes, well, I don't know if Homer wrote that. I mean, you take it, and you're like, this is obviously what he wrote, and this is what he was thinking. And there are 643 copies of the Iliad that we have to compare and contrast. And it's cool because what you see is nearly all the events match one another with just a few small details that don't match up between the documents. Now, when we apply these same standards to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, conservative scholarship would say these were written about 40 AD. The more liberal scholarship says about, you know, 100 AD. So there's a 60-year time frame right there. The earliest copy we have was 150 AD. So 150 AD is when we have the first copy. So only about 75 years on average, if you go kind of in the middle of the 40 to 100, between when it was actually written and the copies that we have. And get this, there are 5,500 copies. 5,500 copies, all virtually in agreement on the details with the exception of a few small details. Now, let me just point out the obvious right here. Look at this right here. I mean, there's no other book that's even close to standing up to some of the metrics of and the number of copies in these ancient antiquities. And yet we don't go around and go, well, I mean, Plato, I don't know if he really lived, right? I mean, nobody walks around and says, Aristotle, I don't know if I can really believe the things that I read about him. You know, and you don't go to literature class and go, well, I'm not showing up today because Homer, I mean, if I can't have an original copy of what Homer wrote, man, I'm just not going to show up for class. No, we don't do that. And yet when it comes to Jesus, when it comes to the Gospels, we play a different game so many times. And in doing so, we actually kind of commit this intellectual and scholarly suicide. Because, I mean, these are just the numbers. I mean, these aren't fabricated. These are apple-to-apple examples right here. And so if we don't want to trust the accuracy of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, I mean, there's no way we should really be trusting what Homer said or what, you know, Aristotle or Plato said. And by the way, you can do this with any of the ancient antiquities. We just picked, you know, like three or four of the most popular ones. See, so many times we believe we've got to check our brain at the door before we walk into a setting like this in order to kind of assent to the things that maybe we talk about in here. And I just think that maybe some of us need to reboot our assumptions. See, maybe as we read the Gospel of Luke over these next few weeks, we actually need to believe this and see this as a part of real history. In fact, I think it's actually really interesting that, you know, why do we have this desire, this need to figure this thing out? I mean, why do we have that? Why do we really want to dig to the bottom of this? I think it's because every single one of us, myself, yourself, we're divine image bearers. I think we actually have the divine image of God planted in our hearts. And whether you know it or not, and whether you understand it or not, I believe we all have the gospel story that's just kind of woven into the fabric of our soul. And you may not have seen it yet, you may not have come to understand it or to know it yet, or even been exposed to it yet. But we have this longing for the story of Jesus that I actually believe happened. And so I just want us to consider the possibility as we begin this journey that this is just a part of history, what we read about Jesus. Now I want you to consider another guy's story who's done a lot of digging into this. Take a look at this.
So can a rational person believe in Jesus? I hope so, because I consider myself a rational person and I believe in Jesus. I think the historical evidence for Jesus as a person is pretty compelling. I don't think there's a lot of controversy about that, although some people even argue about that. But I think for me, one of the really striking aspects of the story of Jesus has to do with his followers. And if you look at the biblical accounts, the different gospels, and certainly what happens in the book of Acts, there seems to have been this incredible transformation that these guys who were hanging out with Jesus were clearly all excited about what Jesus was teaching, and some of them must have thought that it was going to be a political coup or something was going to happen. But then when he was arrested and basically tortured and ultimately killed, all these guys left. And it's pretty clear that they, whatever they thought Jesus was doing or whatever they thought he was, that they now had serious doubts about that, because it seemed like the game plan that they envisioned wasn't coming to play. I mean, it wasn't happening. Within a matter of really a couple days, where the account in Scripture is that Jesus came back from the dead, appeared to his disciples, to his followers, and then left the earth, something must have happened to convince these guys of the reality of not only what Jesus had said, but actually what he had accomplished, which was this coming through death and ultimately coming back to life, to the point where these guys went on to individually die for that faith. I think it's very hard to explain that other than there being something fundamentally profound, something so different about the experience of what they experienced in terms of their interaction with Jesus that convinced them of the reality of what he said about what he was doing and who he was. So I find that a pretty compelling line of evidence that something had happened that was way beyond the ordinary. I think you can accept that idea as a historical evidence for a particular event, but for me, it only takes on reality when we individually accept or turn to examining that claim for ourselves. And it was really only at that point in my life where I started examining that claim about who Jesus said he was and what it might mean that I then started realizing that actually has relevance to me today.
Yeah, let's get up for these guys. Hey, take a look at a couple of these lyrics right here. This is never going to go our way if I have to guess what's on your mind. I mean, if there is a God, don't you think that he would want to do something to be clear about who he is? And how better to be clear than to actually show up right here in the flesh, in the world among us? This is actually what Jesus says in John chapter 14. He says, if you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and you have seen him. If you want to know what God looks like, if you want to know what his character looks like, Jesus says, right here, I'm going to make it crystal clear for you. And if you ever wondered like why God chose that particular time period to show up in the world and why that location in the world to reveal himself to humankind, I mean, I've wondered that. Well, scholars actually believe it was because the whole world was concentrated into one region at that particular time in the history of the world. There was no time before that that had been the case. There's no time after that that's been the case. And so it was in that time period and at that particular place that God chose to reveal himself by coming to the other side of the plane, by coming to our side of reality. I think that's one of the theories that are out there. And so Jesus demands examination. And not only does he demand examination, but when we do examine him, he actually defies our expectations. Jesus defies expectations. We see this in the book of Luke. We see all kinds of detail around Jesus' birth, around his conception. We have all kinds of stuff right there. And then we don't have much detail for like the next 30 years of Jesus' life. And then all the way up to where he kind of comes out and he tells us, hey, here's why I'm here. And then he begins to heal people. He does his ministry. He begins to teach. And then he dies at the age of 33. But there's this like massive gap between his birth and the age of 30 where we have virtually nothing. I mean, for the most part, it's just conjecture. Except for like one story. And we're going to read this one story here as you begin to read through the book of Luke, but I want us to take a look at it right now because it kind of brings something out for us. In fact, the context of this story was the high holy holiday known as Passover. In that particular time period, everybody would go to Jerusalem for the Passover celebration. And so, you know, families from different towns would caravan together, travel together. They'd show up in Jerusalem for this kind of worship experience, party experience, kind of community bonding experience all in one. It was known as the Passover. They'd do that for a few days, and then they would return home, and they would caravan back to their place of origin, wherever they came from. Well, in the midst of all of this, Jesus, he gets left behind. He gets lost. Anybody ever been left behind, lost in your life, like when you were little? Oh, yeah. I got lost when I was like 5 years old in, of all places, a funeral home. I got left behind in a funeral home. My dad was a pastor, and I had to, for some reason, go to this funeral home for a viewing. And I got bored, and I saw one of my little friends. His name was Mikey. And Mikey and I, we ran off into another room that wasn't being used. We started playing hide and go seek. I found like an awesome hiding place. So awesome, Mikey never found me, and neither did my parents. So I don't know that it was that awesome, but all of a sudden, I'd been like hiding for a while. Everything got quiet. And I start walking out, and the lights are off. I walk into the viewing room where the body was with the casket open. There was all lights were off except one spotlight shining down on the body. And I freaked out. Oh, my gosh. My parents left me. I'm gonna die. I mean, I literally thought, like, God was going to suck that body through the light right up into heaven, and I was going to go with it. And so I'm, like, bawling. I'm 5 years old, right? I think I have some trauma from this moment still in my life. The crazy thing, now my parents were out in the parking lot. They hadn't realized yet that I wasn't with them. I think they forgot they brought me. I go busting out the doors, looking, and there they are standing talking to people in the parking lot. And so, you know, I got reunited. And I was at that funeral home earlier this year. I walked in and I said to the person with me, oh my word, this is like surreal. I got left behind in this funeral home as a kid. All right, so I think I have some damage from that. Nonetheless, Jesus, his parents left him. They were boo-hooing. They were bawling. They were like, oh my gosh, we're freaking out. Where's Jesus? Jesus wasn't freaking out. He wasn't freaking out at all. Like, he actually was pretty happy about what was going on, but his parents are boo-hooing, and they're a mess. Now, this doesn't mean they're bad parents because they left him. I mean, in that particular era, they really believed you know, it took a village to raise a child. So they're traveling as a caravan back to their home, you know, town. And they probably just figured he was hanging out with Murray and Beverly Goldberg, you know, hanging out with Adam shooting videos or something. I mean, you know, just normal stuff. They travel a whole day, and they stop overnight. And then the next morning, they realize Jesus is nowhere to be seen. He's not with any of our family friends. So they like hightail it back to Jerusalem, and they go right to the temple, and Jesus is right there in a worship experience with these religious leaders. He's 12, and he's actually participating in the conversation. Here's what it says in Luke 2. It says, everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said to him, son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. Why were you searching for me? He asked. Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house? But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Now, this is very interesting to me right here. See, a lot of us, I talk to people at times that are very bitter, you know, because they don't have some of these experiences like Mary and Joseph. They're like, you know, Mary and Joseph, people like this, they got visited by angels. You know, some of your friends, they're like, they get visited by angels, or they have these high spiritual moments, or they get a vision from God or something. People are like, I never get one of these. If I would have one of those, I wouldn't doubt anymore. All right? I just never have seen one of those. Well, guess what? Mary and Joseph, they had that. They saw that. And guess what? They forgot it. I mean, they lost the plot. I mean, the angel comes to them, right? When Mary conceives and says, hey, here's how this is going to play out. Here's what's going to happen over the next number of years. And somewhere over these 12 years between when Jesus was born and this 12-year-old moment, they lost their purpose and plot as parents with Jesus. And Mary and Joseph, they have to hit the reboot button. I mean, they kind of have to reboot the operating system for a moment. And I'm going to tell you something. They need to hit the reboot button, and you're sitting here thinking, well, I don't know that I need to reboot anything. Well, can we just admit, like, how clueless and prideful it might be for us to think that? I mean, think of it. Mary and Joseph, they're living with, like, the Son of God. All right? They have visions from God, and yet they lost it. They lost the vision. And Jesus says to them, why were you worried about me? Why were you searching for me? Didn't you know I need to be in my Father's house? Like, didn't you remember? See, Jesus right here, he's defying expectations. I mean, they thought he's going to grow up to be a nice little boy. He's never going to cause any problems, never going to cause them any confusion. But Jesus, he defies their expectations. I tell you what, the closer you get to Jesus, the more you understand Jesus, the more you get to know who he is and understand his character, the more he will defy your expectations. Robert Funk is one of the more influential starters of something called the Jesus Seminar. Jesus Seminar, if you're not familiar with it, it was this group of thinkers, this think tank of individuals who were trying to basically devaluate the gospel, devaluate the accounts of the gospel. Basically, the premise, the basic argument was, you know, the people that wrote this were just way too emotionally invested. They had a stake in the game, and so that's why they wrote the story the way they wrote it, which is really interesting. Because if that's the case, then we should believe nothing about, say, something like the Holocaust, right? Because the Holocaust, I mean, we really get that event through, you know, eyewitness accounts that shared what took place, all right? And you may have never even read anything about the Holocaust. You may have heard about the Holocaust, and yet you believe that it took place. And yet, if you post something, like, on your social media, and you're like, well, I don't believe the Holocaust happened, what's going to happen to you? You're probably going to, like, lose your job on Monday morning, right? You're, like, not going to be employed. Like, you just don't do that. You're like, it happened. I've heard about it. I believe it actually happened. You know, the argument that was made in the Jesus Seminar was that these people were too emotionally involved. They had too much, like stake in the game. Well, if you're writing about Jesus in the early days, think about this for a moment. You're actually seeing people being healed. You're actually seeing people who are blind now able to see. You're seeing, you know, people who died, like, come back to life. You're seeing the most loving person you've ever met in your life get beat and beat and beat to a pulp and hung on a cross, and yet he's still doing this extravagant love toward everyone around him. I mean, if you saw this, experienced this, of course you're going to be emotionally connected. Just because you were touched by it doesn't mean that it wasn't real. See, we can always find somebody smart to validate anything we want to believe. But we don't all, it's not every day that we hear somebody who's done the research, who's done the work, who's done the examination, who's intently studied this stuff and then put forth their personal conclusions. This is one of the reasons I'm a huge fan of Anne Rice of the Vampire Chronicles fame. Maybe you've read some of her works. She actually does this. She wrote a book called Christ is the Lord. I've not read the book. I've read actually her author's note at the end, which is fantastic. If you've not read the author's note at the end, I'd at least encourage you to read that, even if you don't read the whole book. Because she basically gives her personal story at the end of this book. It's fascinating. She talks about kind of her upbringing and some of her tradition and her assumptions of Jesus she had and how she grew to actually go, you know, kind of walk away from Jesus because of some of those assumptions that were blown up. She talks about a lot of personal pain in her life. She talks about getting married to an atheist husband. She talks about a son that she had who was gay and how the traditional church just shunned her son. It was incredibly painful for her. And then she just kind of goes on and on about how all of this kind of caused her to not dig into really examining and exploring the real Jesus and investigating him. And I just think it's pretty cool when somebody can acknowledge that. And then she talks about how God began to work in her heart. And these are kind of her own words. And she talks about how she decides to apply some of the same scholarly tenacity that she does in researching nearly for every book that she's written into investigating the person of Jesus. And so I want to read for you kind of a lengthy excerpt from this author's note at the end of Christ the Lord. And I'm not going to put it on the screens because it's so wordy, but I want you to just listen to what she says here. She says, "And what would I write about my Jesus? I had no idea. But the prospects were interesting. Surely he was a liberal, married, had children, was a homosexual, and knew who knows what. But I must do my research before I wrote any one word. These skeptical scholars seemed so very sure of themselves. They built their books on certain assertions, even without examining these assertions. What gradually became clear to me was that many of the skeptical arguments, arguments that insisted most of the Gospels were suspect, for instance, or written too late to be eyewitness accounts, lacked coherence. They were not elegant. Arguments about Jesus himself were full of conjecture. Some books were no more than assumptions piled on assumptions. Absurd conclusions were reached on the basis of little or no data at all. In some, the whole case for the non-divine Jesus who stumbled into Jerusalem and somehow got crucified by nobody and had nothing to do with the founding of Christianity and would be horrified by it if he knew about it, that whole picture which had floated in the liberal circles I frequented as an atheist for 30 years, that case was not made at all. Not only was it not made, I discovered in this field that some of the worst and most biased scholarship I'd ever read was present. I saw almost no skeptical scholarship that was convincing, and the gospel shredded by critics lost all intensity when reconstructed by various theorists. They were no way compelling when treated as composites and records of later communities." It's interesting. Why so much study on who Jesus is? Why so much controversy? Well, I think one of the reasons is because of what Jesus says in Luke chapter 12. He says, "Do you think I came to bring peace on earth? No, I tell you, but division." Now he's not saying I'm coming to be divisive. He's not saying that at all. What he's saying is, I'm coming here and I'm going to be so crystal clear that you're going to have to make a decision. I'm going to make some bold statements, and it's going to be so clear that it's going to require you to react to them one way or the other just because of who I am. That's what he's saying. Anne Rice, she goes on. She says, "Many of these scholars who apparently devoted their life to New Testament scholarship, they actually disliked Christ. Some pitted him as a hopeless failure, others sneered at him, and some felt an outright contempt. This came between the lines of their books. This emerged in the personality of their texts. I'd never come across this kind of emotion in any other field of research, at least not to this extent. It was puzzling. The people who go into Elizabethan studies don't set out to prove that Queen Elizabeth I was a fool. They don't personally dislike her. They don't make snickering remarks about her or spend their careers trying to pick apart her historical reputation." And yet this is what we see with Jesus, because Jesus, he defies expectation. I'm going to tell you something. It's really cool for me this week. I mean, just kind of revisiting some of this research, some of this just kind of ground, kind of regrounding in the basis for why these events actually happen. I mean, it's actually very good for me. And it reminded me, I really don't have to check my brain at the door. I mean, I'm a thoughtful person. And if I admit, sometimes I'm like, okay, did this really happen this way? It was really cool for me. And not only was it cool for me, like at a heady level, it was good for me emotionally as well. You know, periodically somebody will say to me, they'll say something like, "Man, you know, Kurt, it's got to be pretty cool to know that you kind of were the originator or creator of this place called Crosspoint that God just kind of continues to use in touching people's lives." And it is. It's very cool. I mean, it's very humbling to be a part of this. And yet, if I'm completely honest, I get paranoid at times about whether or not I feel that God is going to continue to be able to use me. I mean, there's moments where I just get paranoid. I'm like, oh my gosh. Because I have outages in my life. I have these fears at times. I'm like, what if God just like takes his hand like off of my life? I mean, because I'm a work in process. I mean, God is still like refining Kurt Walters. And sometimes I'm just like, who am I to deserve this? And maybe it's because I'm getting older. Maybe because as I get older, I'm more aware of just the fullness of who I am and maybe even some of my outages. And so as I was looking at those images, you know, of Jesus, I struggle. I struggle with the one of Jesus caring and nurturing, the one where he holds the lamb. You know, I struggle with this idea of is Jesus really going to, you know, like grow me forward and continue to care for me and provide for me? I don't struggle with him as my Savior. I mean, I'm very aware of my outages, my frailties, my brokenness. I mean, I know I need a Savior, but this idea of Jesus wanting to continue to grow me, that in the midst of my weakness, he can use me, and he has these plans to prosper and for goodness in the future, to use my life. I don't always emotionally feel that. And so I need this journey. I'm excited about this journey we're going to go on because I need to reboot some things in terms of my perceptions. And I think we all need this journey. I think we all need to reboot some things in our operating system. Therefore, we are going to experiment over these next few weeks because Jesus deserves experimentation. It's one of the things we're going to do as a part of this journey. And we're going to try to look beyond the criticizing. We're going to look beyond the evaluating. We're going to actively do things that Jesus calls us to do. And we're going to try different spiritual disciplines. In fact, some of you are going to do challenges in your small groups. Not all of you, because some of you may not be willing to take the challenge. There's going to be challenges where you're going to be called to do things for other people, to love other people in ways that maybe you've never done before. There's going to be moments where, you know, you're going to be encouraged to pray. There's going to be moments where you're going to be encouraged to try different prayer experiments. We're going to have a prayer experience like in week 5 where you're going to take an hour to just kind of hear from God. We're going to get into small groups. I mean, for some of us, that's experimenting. Jesus, he had a small group community. I mean, it was called the 12 disciples, right? That was Jesus' small group with the 12 disciples. And yes, he was around some annoying figures in that group. I'm pretty confident, just like you will be in your small group. But he that's where we learn to love each other and show the world what it means to get along. So as we do this, we're going to experience some things. And these things are going to cause us to experience things beyond what we've known before. We're going to experience things that change us. We're going to experience things that take us deeper. That's what I've been praying for. So let's stand. I want to pray for us. And then we're going to sing one more song. And we're going to trust God's going to do some cool things over these next few weeks. God, thank you for this time tonight. Thank you that you call us to deeper things. And I just pray for every single one of us that you would help us to experience something beyond what we know right now. I pray that you create more awareness of who you are in our lives, that we would have more peace and more confidence. And God, as we experiment with you, as we even right now begin this experimental process, God, I just pray that you would cause us to not walk in fear, but God, to confidently try new things, even singing. We're even going to experiment with singing as we're going to do right here.